Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for May 17th, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always from Atlanta, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone.
And also Tim Shiflett. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Good to have you all both on. Here in about 20 minutes, one of our favorite guests, our Texas political insider, Catherine Henchin, will call on in and tell us all of the happenings of the Lone Star State in a little bit. But until then, we're going to discuss all kind of Southern politics. And the first thing is the former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, has been making all kinds of headlines. And I know we kind of all went back and forth early in the week about what his chances are. Tim, I won't call you optimistic on his chances, but in comparison to me, I know you are. What do you think about what's been going on with Jeb Bush and his campaign and really the past week, the polls, the statements, everything else?
Well, for starters, you know, he's been all over the news about this Iraq thing. You know, he was asked on Fox News. First of all, he's on Fox News, right, where they like say – They tell their announcers, hey, these are Republicans on. Give them the answers or the questions before you go on. Be nice to them, blah, blah, blah. Let's make them look good. So the first time he's asked about what would you have done in Iraq, you know, he said he would have done the same thing his brother did. And, of course, he had to take a shot at Hillary. Oh, she would have done it too, blah, blah, blah. Then he's asked about it again the next day, and he says, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then he's asked about it the third day, and he, well, knowing what I know now, wouldn't have done it. So he went from did it to wouldn't have done it. And he didn't look good in the process. Now, my problem right there is, when him and his advisors sat down to talk about this campaign, they had to know that that would be like what? One of the first two or three questions he would even be asked, and he blew the question. You know, he needs to get his game going. The reason I'm more optimistic, I guess, than you, I'm going to withhold judgment for one reason. He's not formally in the race yet. I want to see what happens with him and with these polls, too, which we'll get into here in a minute, before, you know, I say this guy can't be the nominee, because I still strongly believe that he can. What do you think, Catherine?
You know, I am I was surprised about that he wasn't able to answer that question, like, very succinctly. He should have been, like you said, he should have been ready for it. You know, more and more I'm thinking he might not run.
Hmm.
I just think he might decide that he's got a better chance in 2020, hoping that whoever does get elected only has one term, especially if it's Hillary. But, you know, I always say that if you can't run your campaign well, then we certainly can't trust you to run the country, right? I mean, if he can't even be prepared for the inevitable question, I mean, it's inevitable that, like you said, I mean, of course they're going to ask him that. So I'm just wondering, I mean, I think it's odd that he hasn't declared yet. With all these people that have declared, I just am a little surprised. It may be that he just wants to raise some more money before he has to, you know, separate himself from his pack and all that. But I'm just wondering, I'm going to be the lone argument that he may not run.
Yeah, his pack will be well funded if he decided not to run, and that obviously I think is part of it. He's getting that put together. I will say today, the Washington Post, I won't say had an interview with him, but he was on the record on same-sex marriage, and he said he saw no right to same-sex marriage. So that may make it look more like he's running because he's knowing he has to pander to a very hardcore Republican electorate in the primary, and he's boxing himself in. This is going to be a position, if he were to be the nominee, that'll come back to haunt him, I would think. But this may be an indication, too. Catherine, were you surprised to see that he, you know, weighed in so strongly on that issue in the primary?
I didn't see that he had done that, but, yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, I thought he would be if he's waffling on Iraq, you think he'd be able to waffle on marriage equality.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's probably not going to be – it's probably not going to be a – question in the election. It'll be resolved by then, and I think it'll be resolved in favor of marriage equality.
Well, it'll come back to haunt him if he takes one view, and of course in the primary, particularly like early state like Iowa and possibly South Carolina, it's kind of red meat for those folks. Tim, do you think this will, you know, beholden his conservatism, if you will?
Well, you know, he can jump to the right and answer questions from that tact all he wants. I don't think it will do either, and I'll tell you why. I mentioned it to you right before we went on the air. I think his main problem is his brother.
Yeah.
He is going to be constantly bombarded with comments and questions about what his brother did when he was president, and how would he have done the same thing or differently, and did they discuss it privately, and how did he react when his brother did this and that and the other thing. He's going to be bombarded with that in ways that no one else is going to be bombarded with it, of course, because it's his brother. And I don't know if he's going to be able to shake that. We all three know that if he were not related to Bush 43, he'd be waltzing to the nomination.
He would.
Right,
you're
now
absolutely right.
I mean, it would be a coronation much like what's going on in the Democratic side of things. But I just don't know how he's quite going to shake this thing, and that's why I think the nominating process for him, he's going to have to slug his way through these primaries and caucuses. This is not going to be a sprint for Jeb Bush. This is going to be a marathon. It's going to be a brutal one. It's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a close one.
Using the running metaphor, maybe one of those Spartan races where you jump through the fire and you crawl under the barbed wire and everything else.
Uh-huh.
Early in the week, we get into the polls. There was poll after poll, and Jeb Bush was fifth. He was fourth. I know Georgia had one. I forgot if he was fourth or fifth. I mean, fourth and fifth for this guy that was supposed to be the front runner, just terrible. But then you have this Fox poll, which is the latest one, that shows him tied for first with Ben Carson, and then he would be defeating right now Hillary Clinton in the Fox News poll, but it's definitely an outlier. Catherine, looking at particularly the early polls, are you really surprised to be fifth? I mean, that's not even a medal in the Olympics.
No, I'm not surprised. I just think that I think Tim makes a really good point, and I think that, even the Republicans, I'm sure, are concerned. Even if they love W and, you know, don't have the same questions about his presidency as we might, they still must be concerned about voters having concerns about that and his relationship with his brother and his, you know, connection with his brother. And, you know, let's not forget that his father, while not thought of as one of the worst presidents, he didn't win re-election after his first term, which is pretty shocking in this era of, it's uncommon to lose an incumbent, for an incumbent president to lose. And he had his shortcomings. So, I mean, I think that while, you know, dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore Republicans have a, you know, love for the Bush family, I think that there's a lot of, you know, rank-and-file voters who may or may not identify themselves as conservatives or Republicans, but who on whose votes the Republican Party is counting, that they must be there must be some concern about whether they can support Jeb Bush. I'm not a Republican. I can't see that specifically, but I can't imagine that that wouldn't be a legitimate concern that they have.
Yeah. Tim, one of the first ones I sent y'all was the Iowa poll from Quinnipiac, and it showed Jeb Bush at 5%, Walker 21, Rubio 13, Rand Paul 13, Huckabee 11, Cruz 12, Carson 7. This one, he wasn't even fifth. I'm having to really do some hardcore counting and sorting to even figure out where Jeb Bush fits in this poll. But I think I named at least six names, which would make him seventh. I mean, this would be right out of the gate. If this poll were to say hold and the race were to look like this, and he gets to seventh, which is, of course, in the Iowa caucus, sometimes if you don't finish high enough up, you actually lose delegates because they go to somebody that has more, and all those games are kind of played, and he would just drop even further. If he finishes seventh, then he has to go to New Hampshire, which is better territory for him, it looks like, but then goes to South Carolina. The Iowa candidate would likely get more of a bounce in South Carolina. This thing could turn ugly quick. Does he look at these numbers and decide not to run in the Iowa caucus?
It's possible. It is a caucus state. Caucus states are notoriously on the Republican side, not very nice to, shall we say, establishment candidates, which he obviously is the establishment candidate. He doesn't have to win Iowa, of course, to win the nomination. Mitt Romney lost in Iowa. Ronald Reagan lost in Iowa. You know, a lot of people, Bill Clinton lost in Iowa. A lot of people have lost Iowa and went on to the nomination. But it would put a lot of pressure on Bush to do very well in New Hampshire the next week so that it could propel him into South Carolina and Nevada, and right after that, Florida and the Super South primary. I think it would be a mistake not to show the flag in Iowa. I think one reason for his poor poll showing in Iowa is the rumor is out there, and we discussed this before we went on the air too, that he is actually thinking, or his people might actually be considering not entering the Iowa caucuses. I would. This stuff about, well, I can skip this one and that one and stop them somewhere else. You know, let's ask President Giuliani how that works. And I want to throw another question at you right now, David. I said he's the establishment candidate. Are they getting nervous? Are they looking around a little bit behind the scenes now for someone else? Should Bush not make the run or fall flat on his face, as Catherine alluded to?
Yeah, I don't know that the establishment is this thing, but I do know that a candidate is looking at the race that would hurt Jeb Bush with more moderate, middle-of-the-road Republicans. And that would be John Kasich is looking more and more likely at being a candidate for president. And I think Jeb Bush is one of the candidates he hurt. He comes from a swing state, much like Jeb Bush, and this time it's Ohio instead of Florida. And he may be actually looking more at this race because he's thinking, hey, if Jeb Bush falters, maybe I can pick up a lot of his vote, because he might not necessarily pull from Ted Cruz's vote or Rand Paul's vote or some of these other candidates. Probably didn't pull from Mike Huckabee's vote as much, but that only leaves so many candidates left. Maybe he pulls from Walker.
definitely I think Bush, possibly Rubio, and just there's so many ways this thing's going to get it cut. It reminds me of the Georgia Republican primary for Senate. There was a lot of top shelf candidates in that race, and you had sitting congressmen finish like also ran that you don't know their name because there were so many candidates in that race. This thing may be upwards of 11 candidates, and some big names may falter because of that. And particularly because if, you know, if Ben Carson, you know, continues to have any kind of oxygen in his campaign, he may do better than anyone would expect, and he's got to, you know, pull from somebody.
Well, another question. You mentioned the Fox poll and the PPP poll, and neither one of these polls did any of that whole plethora of names break 20%. What's that saying?
It's divided a lot of ways. I mean, is there going to be consolidation? We don't know. It's definitely going to be interesting to watch. If you were just a reporter and you just want to, you know, cover the action, if you will, you'd want to get put on the Republican beat because it's far more unclear about what's going to happen. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton's running against a guy who's discussing his feelings on the War of 1812 and Martin O'Malley. I mean, there's, you know, this one on the Republican side is just, you know, so much more intriguing because of all the different ways people can go and different things. You know, that Fox poll is interesting. Roger Ailes, head of Fox News, this poll just completely looks different, doesn't it, Catherine? It even shows Jeb Bush would defeat Hillary Clinton if this is to be believed. I mean, and then, of course, him leading the Republican field. Could the Bush campaign created a better poll for themselves, Catherine?
Well, you know, who's to say that they didn't, you know? yeah, I mean, I think it's folly to suggest this early in the game that, you know, who's going to beat Hillary Clinton. I mean, they don't even have a candidate yet. They don't even have a lead. Like you said, nobody's breaking 20%. And they're already talking about who can beat the, you know, the, what, 60% favorability, or is it that Hillary Clinton has something like that? I mean, it's really high. Yeah.
David.
Yeah.
In a average of all the other national polling, she's over 8 points ahead of him. That's a pretty big lead when you're averaging every poll together. Now, all of a sudden, they come up when he's sitting at 13% in their national poll and show him as the lone Republican to beat her, which, as you mentioned, Roger Ailes worked for his father. Isn't that just a little convenient?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's of course, there's that Fox News, we might call it stereotype, others might call it the truth, that they're, you know, fairly biased. And this kind of work, you know, it actually's biased against other Republicans for the one they favor, seemingly. Maybe they're the one genius here, but getting it right, but it seems doubtful when you have so many different numbers. I mentioned John Kasich, and I weighed in, but I didn't allow y'all to. You know, Political Wire's reporting that he is strongly leaning towards running. Catherine, how much of a factor do you think John Kasich would be?
I don't think he has very good name recognition. I think the fact that his name is spelled funny is hard. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, but I mean, if he showed up on the TV right now, I wouldn't recognize him. And I'm pretty involved and, you know, well informed. So I think he should just leave the clown car alone. There's really not room for him in it.
Yeah, but that's one thing I will say. I mean, I don't agree with his politics, but he was definitely not, you know, red nose and full wig and everything. I mean, he's a little more serious. If you rank them from, you know, serious candidate to clownish, he's going to be on the more serious end of the spectrum. I mean, he's governor of Ohio. He's still fairly popular in that swing state. You know, he could make the compelling comment that he has a chance to win Ohio. And as we know, Republicans just don't win the White House with Ohio, without Ohio. Tim, what are your your take on John Kasich?
Well, my take is similar to what y'all are saying. You're right. The Republicans have never won without the state of Ohio, not one time. And Catherine's right, what she said. People don't know who John Kasich is. I would know him if I saw him. He used to be on the Sunday morning talk shows a lot when he was in Congress, as y'all might recall. He's kind of an ordinary-looking fella, nothing spectacular. He's fairly articulate without being charismatic. He's not particularly charismatic. He's more cerebral, I would say.
He was the budget guy, wasn't he? When he was kind of the head of the House Budget Committee.
He was a policy and budget wonk, always was. But he might be looking at this thing and saying, you know what? Why not take a look at it? I think that's what Lindsey Graham's really doing. He's probably looking and saying, well, wait a minute, this thing's wide open. Why don't I at least take a look at it? And maybe that's what Kasich is doing. Maybe Kasich is floating his name just to be on the ticket. Sometimes they do that, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
He would, be a compelling choice as VP because it would put the state of Ohio directly into play in a way that it otherwise wouldn't be. They got to win Ohio. They got to win Ohio and Florida. They're not going to win Pennsylvania. They got to win those other two states. Or there's just not an electoral formula there for them. So Kasich, he could be a player in this thing, but I got to agree with Catherine. I don't think he can jump in now and run his way to the nomination. I just don't. So I don't think his name's out there enough. I don't think the average primary voter or caucus goer knows who he is.
Yeah, I think if you looked, I mean, you know, John Kasich's chance or no chance, I would say John Kasich's chance, Lindsey Graham, would be, you know, no chance in my book. Well, let's continue to move on to some other topics. And the Kentucky governor's race is coming up so soon. And two polls were out this week, and both polls are just, you know, kind of flipped, if you will. One has Matt Bevin ahead. The other has James Comer, the agriculture commissioner, ahead. Neither poll has Hal Heiner ahead. And I got to really looking at the crosstabs, particularly on the Survey USA poll, and I noticed that Hal Heiner doesn't even lead in any demographic group that I can find. Now, I'm sure if I look long enough, I might could. But he's not, like, leading, say, voters 65 and above. He's not leading among male or female voters, either one. He's second in a lot of categories. So that's why he's still in play, because this thing's like a point division each way. It's 26, 25, 27. The other poll that Public Policy Polling did had James Comer in, and they were all stacked the same way. I did look in the crosstabs on the Survey USA poll, and James Comer is winning voters 65 and above. And if I had to pick one group in a Republican primary, that'd be the one I'd take. Catherine dropped off, and I think she's dropping back on another phone, but I'm going to go to you, Tim. Tim,
sorry.
What's your take on these? No problem. What's your take on these Kentucky polls?
Well, the race, as tight races often do this, has turned a bit nasty in recent days, as we've seen. It is a three-man race, and it is a pure toss-up. Early in the year, Heiner was leading handily. He's that guy from Louisville. He's a multi-Z in there, and he's self-funding. And he used his money to get out there early and jump to a lead, and he's been eroding ever since as the better-known candidates. Comer, who's the agriculture commissioner, and Bevin, who got the strong backing of the Tea Party up there. He's the Tea Party candidate. as they have come forward. Comer and Heiner have really been throwing bombs at each other. A lot of bad stuff has come out with both of them, with Comer or with Bevin kind of staying out of the way of that. And I'm wondering if Bevin won't slip in there because of that and get the nomination. Now, here's the interesting thing, guys. If Bevin gets it, he is 11 points behind Conway in the polls. Think about that.
Yeah, and we'll continue to discuss that. But right now, we got our guest from the Burn Orange Report, one of our favorite guests from Texas, Catherine Henschen. Welcome, Catherine.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Oh, going good? Yeah, we've been talking about the presidential race, but we covered Jeb Bush, the Florida governor. So now we're going to get you on to talk about some of these, you know, Texas Republicans. And the first one we'll start with is about to announce his campaign, a campaign that I really don't understand why he's running, because he's tried this before and it didn't go so well. Why is Rick Perry doing this again? Is he just a glutton for punishment?
Well, you know, I think one thing we can all be happy about is if we remember Rick Perry's past iconic presidential debate performance, we know he's only going to run twice because he still can't count to three. But, you know, it's not a surprise to see that Texas is, you know, one of the leading exporters of future failed presidential candidates, right? We have Ted Cruz already there in the race who basically announced at a university that forced students to attend or else be fined $10, I believe, you know, and now we've got Perry making a very special announcement, which of course will be that he is going to run for president until he's chased out of the race again. But thankfully, you know, I'm relieved to see that in early polling, both Perry and Cruz are receiving support in the single digits. Of course, it's worth pointing out that with, you know, about 13 people being polled as potential GOP primary contenders, you know, no one's really breaking out at any point. But I just don't see how Rick Perry can recover from his disastrous campaign of the last cycle and how he can basically convince people he's serious and ready for prime time. And I also just don't think Ted Cruz can get the traction on the national level that he's been able to get in Texas, basically by taking advantage of a really strange primary system and, you know, strange primary schedule that we had that helped him get elected in the first place.
Yes, now you kind of mentioned Ted Cruz, so let me ask a question about him, and then I'll pass it on to Catherine. And Tim, Ted Cruz, you know, he's born in Canada, and we've discussed amongst ourselves more than once about the constitutionality of him being able to run and serve as president. Is that much of an issue in Texas?
You know, I think it's kind of an interesting thing. First off, let's be clear. Ted Cruz is a hypocrite about this. He is an American citizen because his mother is an American citizen. But Ted Cruz wants to do away with birthright citizenship. So let's be clear about the fact that under Ted Cruz's ideal immigration rule, Ted Cruz could not run for president. But that has not stopped him. He's very ambitious. In Texas, I think immigration in general is a more complex argument. You know, really what is more interesting is that Ted Cruz will not enjoy much support from Hispanic voters or the Hispanic community. You know, really, Ted Cruz is in office. He is in the U.S. Senate because he decided to challenge a very popular popular elected official, our then Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and nobody really gave Cruz much of a chance, but due to the lawsuits over the unconstitutional redistricting plan that Republicans put in place, the primary got pushed back to May, the end of May, and that pushed the runoff into mid-July, right? Who shows up for a runoff in Texas in mid-July? The most diehard of Tea Party activists. And so Ted Cruz was ambitious and lucky, basically. He had a lot of electoral circumstances really helping him out. You know, that's why he's there. That's not necessarily something he can be guaranteed to exploit in this primary, especially because there's just so many other contenders who can more credibly go after, you know, either he's trying to pitch himself as a religious, you know, conservative, that there's other people who could, I think, make a better claim for that. He doesn't really have too much experience in actual governing at the federal level. And also, let's not forget the fact that there you cannot read a Ted Cruz profile without somebody pointing out how much his colleagues all hate him. So he's just not a popular guy. Something that I've watched personally is where his, and this is also true of, you know, Chris Christie, you look at where their past staff and their key consultants are, and I thought it was very telling that one of Ted Cruz's main digital folks is working with Rand Paul. And I took that to be a sign that, you know, Ted Cruz might have been able to make some magic happen in getting elected in Texas, but, you know, he's not a very popular member of the U.S. Senate, and I don't really see him being able to distinguish himself between a whole bunch of other Republican primary hopefuls.
Oh, it's probably just coloring book envy. well, I'll go ahead and pass this on to Catherine Smith first for any questions about Texas as it relates to the presidential race. Catherine?
Yeah, hey, thanks a lot for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate it. We always like to hear from folks in Texas, and we're all big fans of the Burnt Orange Report. So what's the sort of general, like, conversation about these candidates in Texas? Is there a lot of, like, you know, discussion, like, at the water cooler and on the blogs and on Facebook feeds and stuff? Are people lining up against them or for them, or like, what's the general sort of,
you know,
is
so
there?
Our legislative session is going on right now, so I think what political intrigue there is more surrounding what's happening at the legislature and where those folks might be going with their challenges, right? A first term state senator who literally has not been in office a full 6 months yet is talking a big game about challenging Pete Sessions. We've got some potential legislators and folks in there looking at making some other runs themselves for other office. Realistically, I think that because everybody has known that Rick Perry would run again, and everybody has known that Ted Cruz was setting himself up to run, I think it's sort of a non-event right now. It's not anything new or interesting. You know, and it's a long way off. You know,
yeah.
we've got the last few weeks of the session. Some people think we might have a special session, and a lot of in-state issues that are really getting the lion's share of the attention. What I do think is interesting is that even though the Cruz and Perry presidential campaigns are kind of a not very interesting right now, the two of them respond to everything that is going on, right? So we had our military was conducting some training exercises in a county outside of Austin, and, you know, Greg Abbott basically pandering to the crazy secessionist contingent is sending letters saying, we're going to spy on you, and using the kind of rhetoric that is just absolutely pandering to these anti-government, extremists, for lack of a better word. And when something like that happens, and then that's been a huge news story here at Texas, becoming a national news story, when something like that happens, both Perry and Cruz respond, right? And I believe Ted Cruz, you know, kind of chimed in with the kind of fear sort of element, where Rick Perry, interestingly, took it as a chance to contrast himself and was like, this is ridiculous, right? Which, you know, it's funny when Rick Perry is saying that someone's actions as governor is ridiculous, then maybe that should cause a several moments of self-reflection. But, you know, that's where I think it comes in, that they're angling to get themselves in every story. They're always looking to comment on the issues of the day in a way that distinguishes themselves from other people in the primary. And that, I think, with so many Republicans looking to run and each of them trying to carve out a slice of the electorate, that, I think, is kind of the interesting part. What are they doing to distinguish themselves to the voters? You know, I just think in terms of Perry, I just don't see how he really regains the confidence and credibility that this is the guy that should have the nuclear launch code after his last year. which is, of course, very interesting from the perspective of being in Texas, where he was our longest-serving governor. He was able to defend, you know, any serious challenge to his governorship, and he was able to do a lot of really, you know, problematic things policy-wise and kind of skate by, in part because the state is so overwhelmingly controlled by Republicans, and the media really just doesn't do the work they need to do in calling that out for fear of losing access. But I think to the rest of the country, Rick Perry is like the punchline to every other joke about Texas. In terms of Ted Cruz, he's really done a good job of making himself into sort of a tragic comic evildoer, you know, kind of like a snidely whiplash of the U.S. Senate in some ways, where he's like, I'm going to shut down the government, or, oh, the Senate doesn't like me. I'm going to go have meetings in a basement with some House Republicans and see what I can get going on over there. You know, he's very, very impressed with himself, you know, and trying very hard to make a national profile for himself. My main question is, because I really think that Ted Cruz's campaign is going to go nowhere extremely quickly, is what does he do after he loses? He is in a Senate that, you know, God willing, is going to be a Democratic Senate after the next election, and we're going to have a Democratic president still in office. What does Ted Cruz do? His colleagues don't like him. Does he decide to sort of buckle down and actually do some work in the U.S. Senate? Does he decide not to bother running again in a few years? You know, what is it? What is it that he would want to do? I mean, I do think that if a Republican were elected president, Ted Cruz would see if he could angle himself in for potentially, you know, a Supreme Court appointment or something like that. But otherwise,
oh,
I just don't see what kind of career trajectory he really has.
Well, let me just say that from now on, every time I see Ted Cruz, I'm going to think of Snidely Whiplash, and I thank you for that because it will give me endless joy, and I really like that. I'm going to have to go ahead and pass it to Tim.
Good evening, Catherine. How are you?
We're doing good.
And I'm not too worried about Governor Perry with the nuclear launch codes. I'm like you. If there's no more than two numbers in the code, he's great, right? Right. You know, there's another family in Texas of some political note in Republican circles. Their name is Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if the primaries advance, we get to the state of Texas, we got a close race, and it's a knockdown drag out, of course, for a lot of delegates right there. And you've got Jeb Bush on the ballot, and you've got Senator Cruz and Governor Perry. Who's going to fare best among those three in that state?
You know, I'm inclined to say that Rand Paul is going to do a lot better in Texas than anybody expects. You know, his father, granted his father was a congressman in Texas, but he always performed very well. I think that Rand has a capacity for organizing and understand how to appeal to a slightly younger generation. You know, he appears to be maybe sort of kind of moderate on marijuana and drug issues. I think that he is going to do better than a lot of people expect. I think a lot of it comes down to how far along any of those candidates have even made it by the time the primary gets here. And, of course, we have a primary caucus system. We have both popular votes. And then a precinct level convention that takes place as well. So you know, there is a certain degree of organizational challenge. I can tell you that where Jeb Bush is getting his support in Texas is from Houston and Dallas, from the very wealthy business Republicans. I've seen some invitations for some early fundraisers for his campaign, and you know, he's got a pretty impressive roster of wealthy Republicans and wealthy business leaders. That's not a big surprise, right? That's kind of his constituency. You know, overall, looking at the race, the one that if I was handicapping it right now, you know, I do think there's a decent chance that Jeb Bush does become the nominee. But I think also at the same time, Scott Walker is the person that Democrats in general should be keeping an eye on because he's managed to get elected in a Democratic state, in a pro-labor state of Wisconsin. and then has proceeded to just shred the social safety net, worker protection, gut education. You know, he's like a, he is the Koch brothers' fever dream, right, I think, of a president. And I wouldn't be too surprised to see Walker really start getting a lot of traction. And that worries me, you know, as a citizen of this country, it worries me the thought that Scott Walker could potentially be the next president of the United States. In terms of, you know, the election coming up, I don't really see any of the Texas candidates really going too far. And since it's a proportional system here, right? Basically the delegates from Texas will be apportioned through both the primary and the caucus system, going all the way to the state convention, where really what matters is if your people keep coming and keep showing up for you. That's what makes the difference. That, you know, I think Perry will do fine. He's got some people here. Cruz will do fine. Obviously, he's got some people here, too. But I'll be a little bit more curious to see if these campaigns that may be more organization-minded look at the just huge number of delegates in Texas to really try and not necessarily run up the score, but prevent anybody else from getting much of an advantage.
Mm. Speaking of Governor Perry, is there any chance that he might be just keeping his name in the news for a future run in Texas for some office, or is this run for the presidency his last political hurrah?
Well, it's tough to see what else he would really get elected to here in Texas. He was the governor for 18 years. He has appointed basically every person in every branch of government. He held basically complete control over the state for a really long time. You know, I think he got to the point, though, where he accomplished everything he was ever really going to accomplish, and I think there started to be some severe pushback against him. And it was no surprise to me when Wendy Davis caught so much traction in the summer of 2013 that Perry decided not to run again. I think that it would have been a very different race with Wendy Davis running against an embattled Rick Perry, who had gotten a lot of criticism for some of the things that he'd done over the years. In terms of Greg Abbott, he came in with sort of a fresh, cleaner slate, shall we say. I think that it's similar to the question about Ted Cruz. What does Ted Cruz do after he loses, because he doesn't have any friends in the Senate? I don't really know what Rick Perry does either. He started a leadership pack, right? So he's raising money to give to other Republicans ostensibly. I just don't know what he does in terms of going forward from this.
Hmm. All right. Thank you, David.
Yes. Catherine, still looking at presidential politics, but switching over to the other side of the aisle. A lot of Democrats are anxious to make some of these states that are big population states that really aren't even purple yet begin to be purple. And one of the ways it's postulated is you take a Texas Democrat or a Georgia Democrat, but let's go to Texas, or an Arizona, I guess, Democrat. But in Texas, you have the Castro brothers. Would either one of them be like a good choice for the vice presidential nomination to try to move Texas along to swing state status? Or is there another name that maybe some outside of Texas folks don't know?
Sure. You know, it's a good question. I think in general, should Secretary Clinton win the Democratic nomination, which I think is highly likely, should she end up in choosing a vice president, obviously she should pick the person she thinks is best capable of fulfilling the job. Of course, many of us in Texas think that Julian Castro, former mayor of the city of San Antonio, now Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, would be a great choice to be a vice president. And certainly, you've seen his national profile really go up. You know, he gave a really great speech at the Democratic National Convention back in 2012, and he then got appointed to Obama's cabinet, where he is using housing to help address issues of veteran homelessness and also doing some good work on just in general creating opportunity. He has some really great things to say about the infrastructure of opportunity such that other kids can grow up, get the best education possible, and go be successful in what they aspire to. You know, he is definitely an exciting figure, a young rising star in national Democratic politics. should Hillary choose him to be her running mate, you know, it's tough to say what kind of impact that would have in Texas simply because at this point, you know, the margin is pretty high for Texas between Democrats and Republicans. You know, we are not making the kind of gains we had hoped to see over the last few election cycles. So I think if she did choose Castro, it would probably not be with an eye of flipping Texas. I think that it would definitely improve Democratic performance in some of our more traditionally Hispanic areas of the state. I also think it would help her in other states with substantial Latino populations. And here I'm thinking, of course, of Nevada, but also states like North Carolina, states that are rapidly approaching, you know, swing state status that have substantial Latino and Hispanic populations, Georgia being another one. You know, it's just tough to fathom the scale of what is needed in Texas. Democrats are about 1 million votes short winning a statewide election. That's really a large amount of infrastructure building and financial investments. And if you look into this election cycle, for Democrats, right, what are our strategic imperatives? The first is holding on to the White House. That's a fairly straightforward map of key blue states and swing states that will be targeted. Then there's the Senate, right? We have the chance to knock out a whole lot of the senators that got elected in the 2010 wave. We've got, you know, states like Illinois, right, a blue state with a senator who's going to have to answer to his Republican voting record. We've got, you know, Nevada. We've got some great opportunities to either hold Democratic seats or pick up Republican ones. And then, you know, we'll have some congressional seats that are more competitive and better for Democrats in presidential cycles than in midterm. So there's a lot of other strategic imperatives. You know, if I was, you know, looking into the future several years, if Hillary did pick up and decide to make Julian her vice presidential candidate of choice, then I think we would see some gains in 2020. I think that by then, there would have been hopefully some more Democratic infrastructure and some shifting in terms of demographics and just some overall improvement in Democratic performance leading into 2020, which is when we might be able to see Texas more approaching a swing state status.
Yeah, I guess the reason I find this intriguing is the same way for the Republicans. If Democrats take away Texas, the Republicans are done. Just like if, in the current environment, I think if the Republicans could take away California, the Democrats are in dire straits. I think we could see where we could possibly one day take Texas. I don't know what that formula for Republicans is on California, but if somebody could figure it out on their side, it would behoove them. Well, let's continue to talk about some of these topics. Tim and Catherine, you know, break in if y'all are there, ask these questions that we kind of had directed Catherine to. Catherine Smith?
I'm not prepared, so I'm going to go ahead and send it over to Tim. I might have something in a minute.
Oh, I would just love to ask you about Louis Gohmert, if you have time to write a book, you know. look, when we know he has a penchant for saying some things that are a little out there, and that's putting it charitably. But when he says things like, there are ISIS camps all along the Texas border, or he compares the president to Hitler, or he talks about women, pregnant women coming to the United States so they can have babies and raise them as terrorists. Does he actually believe things like that?
You know, I have not peered into the vast space of Louis Gohmert's psyche and consciousness. You know, I think it's an interesting that he is basically able to do this without any. At some point, I think it says how not seriously he is taken if he is able to go and make these pronouncements. And, you know, on one hand, he doesn't lose his seat. You know, it's very hard to oust an incumbent. He's been in there so long, I'm sure he knows half the people in his district. You know, I think at some point, though, what I wonder more is when will the kind of educated or common sense Texans, and there are perfectly common sense Republicans who are simply interested in, you know, lower taxes and lower government spending, when will these folks basically realize that he is an embarrassment to their team, that the Republicans are put on defense every time Louie Gohmert opens his mouth, and it's embarrassing to the party that someone is out there saying these things, right? It's profoundly disrespectful and inane. I don't think many people take it seriously. I think that certainly there's an element of the fringe of folks that are way out on the right wing and who, you know, read a little bit too much Breitbart, who absolutely listen to what Gohmert is saying and think, you know, it's the gospel truth. But I just don't really see him getting any traction for anything beyond his outrageous statement.
Well, in his district, I believe it's the first district in Texas, last year he got like 78% of the vote in the general election. I realize that, you know, that's a very red district against a Democrat, but it would seem that one of those common sense Republicans that have been alluded to tonight would say, wait a minute, I could go after this guy. You know, I could go get this guy. Would that be possible with the makeup of his district for him to have someone in his own party knock him off?
You know, I think that it's possible that a Republican could decide that they wanted to make a case that Louie Gohmert was not delivering for his district. Obviously, you know, this is not a district that a Democrat is going to win. I would say Louie Gohmert is even outside of, right, like, dead girl, live boy level of defeat, just based on how purely Republican and how high the straight ticket vote total is in his district. You know, in terms of the primary, it's something to consider if there was somebody locally who really was tired of their congressman being held up merely as a national embarrassment for their party. What I will note, though, is that in Texas there has been so much turnover over the last few years in terms of, you know, we had many, probably like three or four contestants in the Republican primary for each of the statewide offices that were just elected last year. There's no endless shortage of state senators running something statewide. So then four state reps run for that Senate seat. So then 16 people run for those collective state representative seats. On some level, if you really want to become an elected official as a Republican, the state level simply offers, I think, more opportunity and more opportunities potentially for quick advancement. You know, I sometimes wonder why anybody would really want to be in Congress, barring, like, at this point, major reforms to how redistricting is done and how elections are financed. Why does someone want to go be in an elected legislative body that has approval, you know, in the single digits if they are lucky at this point, you know? If you are in the state house in Texas, you can potentially get things done. You know, the session is short, but people can get things done and move legislation if they are smart and hire good people and work well with others. There is a lot more that can be done on the state level. You know, we have also local municipal positions, right? We have city councils and mayors and county commissioners and county level elections. I think that if there's someone in Gohmert's district that is interested in breaking into politics at some point, looking at those races must seem like such a better chance of winning and less aggravation than having to run against a very long-term congressman.
So you're saying then most definitely that probably the young GOP talent in that state is going to be looking to run for state wide offices or something, or legislative offices, before they'd ever look at a congressional seat then?
You know, I think for a lot of the serious folks that makes more sense. Now, at the same time, right, we have Ralph Hall, one of the oldest members of Congress, and he got knocked out in a primary from his Dallas area seat by, you know, someone who said he wasn't delivering. I think the conditions are ripe. I just don't know how much it really, you know, I think it takes a certain kind of person to challenge a long-term incumbent or a long-term widely known figure, regardless, you know, that's true regardless of party. It's not something that people do simply because of the way politics is structured and the way, you know, campaign finance laws are structured and the challenges of mounting a credible campaign. I think at some point someone might do it, but I think in the short term there are other lower hanging fruit for people that want to serve. I guess the question I would say, I would flip that question around and say, why would anybody in their right mind get in a primary against a 10-year incumbent with very high name ID in an extremely right-wing conservative district only to be successful and then have to go serve in Congress?
On that happy note, I'm going to throw it back over to David.
Yes, Kath, our time's short, but I want to ask about this. You know, so many times we need things to bring us together. We would hope that, you know, good food would be something that could bring us together in Texas. You have Tex-Mex and I'm sure fine steaks and other things. But lately food has been very political for a lot of Texas politicians. What's going on with this obsession with food and politicizing it?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think, you know, a lot of it gets into the broader issue of, you know, kind of like, lifestyle politics, right? I'm going to express my political views by whether or not I'm going to eat a Chick-fil-A, right? Or I'm going to boycott this place because they're pro-LGBT rights or anti-LGBT rights, for instance. Now, I think for a lot of people, especially in Texas, right, whether you're, especially if you're a Democrat, but I think it's also true if you're a Republican who is dissatisfied with the way things are going in some aspect of state government, right? I think for a lot of people, it's really hard to feel that election impacts their lives in a meaningful way or that they can make a difference, right? People feel kind of low on political efficacy. Who does feel high on political efficacy? You know, wealthy mega donors and people who control swaths of the electorate, outspoken leaders of various political groups, right? These folks have a lot of ability to influence, but I think a lot of average citizens just don't. And so one way they feel like they can manifest their beliefs is through how they spend their money, what stores they go to, you know, where they eat, which fast food chain they prefer, all of those things. You know, beyond that, I think it's, you know, to a certain degree, it's also worth remembering that Texas is really, really large. So in many cases, it's only the, if you get outside a lot of the major urban cities, really your only food and drink options are likely to be chains and fast food chains, you know, and huge, huge national burger chains and that sort of thing. So for a lot of folks, that's just the only choice they have. So those are the kind of restaurants people grow up going to and eating at, and that's just what they're familiar with, this idea of shopping local or buying local may not be incredibly salient. So if what you've always known is these big national chains and then one of them somehow gets out in front of an issue that you either support or disagree with, right, that is very much, I think, an understandable way for people to engage with their political views in some sort of day-to-day basis.
Yeah, well, I guess for all Texans, I hope Whataburger stays depoliticized because whereas a lot of places we have Wendy's and Checkers and Hardee's on every corner, it seems like in Texas it's Whataburger. So hopefully
definitely
they haven't entered the fray. Yes.
Yeah,
no, Whataburger's in Georgia. I've yet to see any. We got all the, you know, mix of the other ones, if you will. Well, Catherine, thanks again for coming home. Before you go, anything else on the Burn Orange Report you want to tell us about?
You know, definitely I think folks should be keeping their eye on the legislature for the last two weeks of the session. One of the big victories, you know, basically the Democrats work really hard to stop bad Republican legislation from getting passed. And we had a big victory Thursday. Thursday was the last day for a bill to be heard in the House for I believe, first reading or second reading, and any bill that has not gotten a vote by midnight was dead. And one such bill is a virulently anti-LGBT bill, which basically said that if the Supreme Court did rule in favor of marriage equality, no state or local official was allowed to issue a same-sex marriage license, right? So these folks are so desperate, and like there's this part of me that is like, please just go to therapy and work out whatever your issues are surrounding same-sex couples. It, to me, seems extremely sadly pathological at this point. But that bill had to get a vote, and it was at the end of a very long calendar of bills, and Democrats debated lots of other bills and ran out the clock, and so that bill never made it to the floor on
Yay,
Thursday, which is good.
Job.
What's really
good
important
job
about that
the...
bill, yeah, they did a great job. What's really important about that is that bill was a potential model bill for other state legislatures looking for ways to potentially, you know, stop the horrible onslaught of civil rights in America. And actually, is patterns